From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a Milwaukee area group forms to attract girls and women to technology fields, plus why nonprofits should think closely about the work of their governing board.
You have many people who have sat on a lot of boards over many, many years who feel they understand governance, they know what to do, and unfortunately it hasn't been working very well.
We'll talk about the effect of CGO, car gizmo overload.
One of my other pet peeves is rain-sensing wipers. I think I know when it's raining, and I can turn on my own wipers. It's not hard. You reach, you pull a knob, you turn a knob. It really doesn't take much effort.
And why Red Sox Nation matters even behind the cheddar curtain. Lake Effect comes your way next, after this news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We've talked on this program in the past about the issue of involving more women and girls in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. And gains have been made in some areas. Recent data from the National Science Foundation shows that women receive more than half of all undergraduate degrees awarded in STEM subjects. But still, there are significant gaps in areas such as computer sciences and engineering, in which women represented only 18% of all degree recipients. A new organization is trying to change the paradigm in southeastern Wisconsin in particular. Beth Ackerland is managing director of the group Girls in Tech, the Milwaukee chapter. She's with us in the studio now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
What is your ultimate hope for the work you are doing with Girls in Tech? If everything goes right, what is your impact going to be?
So I think there are a lot of women working currently in Milwaukee, southeastern Wisconsin, in technology fields. I also think, you know, there isn't necessarily a platform for them to come together and learn from each other. And I think there isn't a lot of women out there or younger girls who know about tech careers or skills. So our ultimate goal is to expose those and grow education and grow skills and knowledge surrounding that space.
Well, and what's the age range you're concentrating on? Because it sounds like you have at one level people you're trying to get interested in these fields altogether, and then at the other end of the spectrum, people who are already interested, making them more comfortable in these fields.
Right. It's all ages. I mean, I think it starts very young, middle school age, even before then. I mean, you have kids playing with iPads or what have you. That's just the world we live in these days, is very technology focused. It could be someone who just wants a career change and they don't know the skills they need. They don't know what jobs are out there. So it's a variety of ages, and I think technology is for everyone.
Well, what's the approach you're taking?
So what we want to do is, for people who are already in technology, is have that platform to be able to kind of peer mentor with each other and learn about what each other does. I think that helps facilitate education and grow skills. I also think talking to schools or partnering with, you know, younger organizations, let's say Girl Scouts, and just kind of partnering with them and working towards getting that knowledge out there and that awareness of the available jobs or the education that they can get.
Is Girls in Tech a group that, I mean, do you have meetings? How do you bring people into the fold?
Right. So Girls in Tech is a global organization, and it's started in 2007. It's a nonprofit, and there are about 32 chapters worldwide. Each chapter can really cater to the market it's in. So there's a San Francisco, there's one in Chile. So it's really based on what that market, so let's say Milwaukee, is in need of.
Well, and we hear a lot about mentoring and how important it is to get people comfortable in particular roles. How does it work? I mean, how do you see a good, you know, what do you see a good mentor doing?
I think a good mentor is just very open and honest about what they're doing. I think, you know, peer mentors, you just by talking and helping each other, you know, something that might be difficult, how did you overcome that? Or this skill I want to develop, how can I go about doing that? And learning from experiences is really what peer mentoring is about, and sharing those experiences. So that's our goal, is just build those relationships with each other and learn from each other based on our experiences or paths we've taken to get where we are.
Why are you so passionate about this? So what made that you are in a technical career?
Yeah.
What made the difference for you?
I think I had a lot of great leaders and mentors along the way. I mean, I was an economics major. I always had an interest in technology, but didn't really know how to get there. So kind of each step of the way, just sharing experiences or asking questions and having coworkers, colleagues, bosses, other leaders in my life, just answering those questions and providing their input just kind of led me down the path. So I think that's what Girls in Tech is really trying to do as well, is just facilitate those conversations and mentoring opportunities to help people grow in those careers or expand their interests.
Did you have any gender challenges, for lack of a better term? I mean, did gender come into it when you were coming along?
Going into stats, there's about 56% of U.S. occupations that are held by women. Only 20% of technology careers are held by women. I think we need to change the perception of what tech careers are. It encompasses so much more than just kind of tech. It's not just programming, engineering, computer science, product marketing, design, entrepreneurship. There's so much that goes into it. I don't think that's exposed. So I think kind of that perception of it being more unattractive is what we're trying to break down and just get an understanding of that this is a really fun space and women and young girls should be attracted to it. It's a great, great opportunity. There's a demand there for jobs.
Where are things with the Milwaukee chapter of Girls in Tech?
So we just had our launch event. It was during Flying Car Innovation Week. Milwaukee is a great city to start this up. There's so much buzz around innovation. Everyone's embracing technology. And I think when we started, two other women helped launch this, Kirsten Corbell and Cindy Thomas from Translator. We kind of got together and said, I think there's a need for this. Let's put it out there. So we got over 50 attendees, and we kind of just had a conversation about what does Milwaukee need? What can we provide? How can we help in these areas for girls in tech? So our next meeting is we're starting a breakfast series. It's going to be Wednesday, July 31st at 8:15 a.m. We have one in Bayview at Altera and one in Brookfield at Panera. And we're going to be holding topics of conversation or topics of discussion and then just kind of providing that peer mentorship and relationship building just by having conversations with each other. In the future, we want to do workshops, maybe career fairs, events to build those skills and learn from each other as to the interests we want to go into.
Well, and is it safe to say at this point you were looking for both potential mentors and also mentees?
Yeah, I think you can be both a mentor and a mentee just by having those conversations with each other.
How, aside from appearing on radio shows, how are you reaching out? How are you casting your net for people who are the right fit for you?
So we have a Facebook group, Girls in Tech Milwaukee, a meetup group. We are doing a lot of word of mouth, social media. We have two sponsors, Centaire and Translator, who have helped us kind of get off our feet. And kind of from here, we are reaching out via email and via those channels with starting some committees. So we want to get people on board who has interest in youth outreach, peer mentoring education, marketing, membership and sponsorship, and just getting people engaged that way and how we can branch out.
So you're very much at the beginning of things.
Definitely.
Well, Beth Ackerland, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Beth Ackerland is managing director of the Milwaukee chapter of Girls in Tech and an agile product owner at a company called Centaire in Brookfield. You'll find a link to more about Girls in Tech from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. We'll find out how nonprofit boards of directors are changing in an era in which the economics of nonprofits are evolving as well. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. There are nonprofit organizations in many sectors of life, from education to arts to media. But what nonprofits have in common is how they're governed through a board of directors. But what makes some boards successful in guiding a nonprofit group while others spin their wheels? A new book on nonprofit boards offers advice in just that area. It's called You and Your Nonprofit Board. The book includes chapters by two Milwaukee nonprofit executives, Frank Martinelli and Pat Wisbinski, who are with us in the studio. It's edited by Terry Temkin, who joins us on the phone from Florida. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's so great to be here, Mitch.
Let me start with a big question about nonprofit board management, if you will. What's at stake from this issue? You know, why write this book? Why is it important for nonprofits to be taking kind of a big picture approach to the work of their boards? And I'll throw that to all three of you.
You know, one of the differences between for-profit corporations and nonprofits for many years, the traditional look at the sector, is that the board is the difference. Both have profit motive in that they want surplus funds if you're a nonprofit. But the way the board acts and oversees the organization has been typically different in the nonprofit sector. They've been more engaged in looking at many responsibilities besides the bottom line.
And it's a particular kind of board. It's a governing board. And the word governance, from the Greek word meaning to steer the ship, there's a lot at stake because the board, more than any other leadership entity in the nonprofit, is responsible for charting the future course.
Terry Temkin, what are your thoughts in terms of why this is so key?
I would like to indicate why it's so key now. I think Pat and Frank did a great job talking about why governance is important, why a book on governance is important. What differentiates this book and why this was so important now is that in the last few years, certainly since the economic downturn, we have realized in this sector that we need to do things differently. And you have many people who have sat on a lot of boards over many, many years who feel they understand governance, they know what to do, and unfortunately it hasn't been working very well. And we've really had to change course. And the reason why now and the reason why for this book is to help people see some of the new ways that they might think about doing things in order to be more successful so that we have stronger communities in the long run.
What hasn't been working so well? Why, you know, what have been the common missteps, either in the relationship between nonprofits themselves and their boards or just in the work of the boards themselves?
Certainly the whole issue of how do we fund an organization at a time like this, and that's not fully the board's responsibility to take that on as a sole responsibility, but boards have had to be very creative in how they approach it. It's looking at the size of the board, how the board can approach things. We've learned that one of probably the most important things is that governance isn't necessarily happening in the boardroom anymore. You've got funders who are dictating the direction an organization should go. They'll say, we'll be happy to give you money if you provide XYZ services that we know you haven't really been providing in the past, but this is what we want.
You know, Mitch, one of the things that I've seen over the years is that we have this concept of throw a group of people from disparate backgrounds together at the same board table and say, go govern. But it's not something that comes to us naturally. It is something that we have to learn how to do. How do we keep the mission of the organization in the front of us as we make a wide array of decisions about money, staffing, and vision of the organization?
I think another thing that really gets in the way of good governance for many organizations, for many nonprofit boards, is in this period of rapid, profound change, too many boards spend too much of their time looking backwards. And clearly, there's a stewardship responsibility. We have to ask questions about performance year-to-date, things of that nature. But increasingly, there is the realization, and it's reflected in the book in so many of the contributions, that a great board needs to spend more and more of its time in meetings and outside of meetings looking up and out at the horizon. What's happening? Which of those changes and trends are going to have the greatest impact on the people that we're presuming to serve, and then make decisions accordingly?
Well, and let me ask you about that notion, maybe all three of you, about that notion of training board members and recruiting the right ones. Can anybody know for certain who is likely to be a visionary until they make it to the board?
I think that there are personality traits that really move the group along. And those that we would say are always asking big picture questions are wonderful. But if we have a whole room full of big picture people, nobody's going to be writing the thank you notes or thinking about the details. So when you put a board together, you're really looking for a wide array of both personalities and professional skills and talents.
There's a statement that's gone around for a long time that when you've seen one board, you've seen one board. And you can have people who have sat on many different boards, and they have that experience. I am 100% behind Pat's answer. I think, though, that what is very helpful, and Frank alluded to it in his response, is that when you pull this group of very strategically selected people together, they still need to know about this organization. They still need to know about the culture of this organization. They still need to know how they can best represent this organization. And they need some training to do that. Nobody, as I think Pat said earlier, nobody's born knowing how to do this.
And there's no question that being on a board is an incredible opportunity to learn how to be a better, more effective leader. But so much is riding on what boards are responsible for that we have to do a certain amount of due diligence before someone comes onto the board. We have to, in a sense, move some of the process further upstream. We don't wait to see what we've gotten after we've gotten the invitation answered in the affirmative. We've got to spend time with prospective board members to really get a sense of them. What kind of a leader, what kind of a contribution will they make to the board? And is it in line with this notion of visionary, future-focused leadership?
Well, and I wonder if there's a certain amount of making sure that the board members understand their expectations before they take their position on the board.
Absolutely. We don't do that enough. Frankly, I see, and I know that Pat and Frank will agree, too often you have people who say, please, 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 we want you on this board. You're dynamic, you're bright, you're perfect for it. You won't have to do very much, I promise. You just have to show up at meetings once a month. And what that does is really set a very sad trajectory for the board and for the individual, because either this person who is so bright and dynamic, et cetera, is going to say, then why do you want me on the board? And they will run the other direction, or they'll come on and they'll believe you, and then they don't do anything. The setting of the expectations is critical.
Yeah, picking up on that, I think sometimes we just make the assumption that if we tell people what they're actually getting themselves into, they'll run for the door. I would argue that if they run for the door after we've told them what we really need, then let them run for the door. I think sometimes the opposite happens. We tell people the kind of challenge that we're offering them, and especially today and especially among young people, they want to hear that. They want to be part of a group that is really making a difference.
And active engagement is critical, not to just come to meetings and listen to somebody else's report about what they did last month, but what are the thorny problems we need to think about? What's the skill set that we need at this table in order to move us to the next level, whatever that might be? I think that most people would rather come and be active rather than just write a check. Because if you're just going to write a check, there's a different kind of board to sit on rather than the governing body.
Well, and Pat, you spoke about this notion that nothing will get done if you just have big picture thinkers on a board, say, or even like one type of personality on the board. Are nonprofits – you kind of write about this – the nonprofits in need of thinking about how these boards are subdivided, or the organizational structure that exists within the board?
Well, I often, as an exercise when I'm working with the board, is to ask them to draw a picture of their corporate structure. How many appendages are there and how do they relate to each other? It's interesting that most times the end result is one or two boxes on a page, when in reality there are many different working groups that feed information to a board so that it can make decisions, or the board discusses something that someone else can make a decision. But to put it in writing in a form of a picture to see how those relationships are accountable to each other is a very important exercise. There are many different models. We can use boxes and circles and triangles and stack them on each other as traditional boards have done. But in the book, I write about a Nautilus model where we kind of start in the center with the board and just keep adding chambers as tasks are needed around the center of the organization. There's also what I call the farmhouse model, where it's just whenever we need something, we just put in a new outbuilding. So it doesn't really matter what model you use. What matters is that you are aware of the model. You can draw a picture of it and understand how all the appendages relate to each other.
Frank Martinelli, it seems unlikely that these are the kinds of changes that can occur overnight, especially given that organizations are unlikely to throw out an entire board and replace it with new members. What are the baby steps that organizations ought to take as they re-envision what their boards can and should do?
Well, and before the first baby step is taken, we need to talk about leadership, that the kinds of things that we're alluding to, the kinds of changes that can make a good board a great board, it all requires leadership, leadership on the part of the board itself, and leadership within the executive staff, the CEO, the executive director, working in partnership with board leadership. That willingness, that readiness to change is just absolutely essential. Beyond that, a lot of organizations begin with some kind of a snapshot of what currently exists, a board assessment, and there are several tools. A number of them are referenced in the book. So taking a snapshot of capacity within the board at this point in time, giving the board an opportunity to identify the short list of priorities. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was a great board. What are the things that we're going to work on first? And I think in that selection of the short list of priorities, thinking about where's the leverage. We can't do everything at once, but where are the areas that if we really focused attention, if we succeeded in those two or three areas, that would have a spillover effect because it's high leverage.
Terry Temkin, the title of the book leads one to believe that this is aimed at nonprofit managers, but it seems like it might behoove people who either are serving on boards or considering serving on boards to read this as well.
Actually, I would say the latter is more the case, and we would love to have the, quote, managers, whether they're executive directors or team leaders, read it. But I would extend that out and say that anyone who consults with nonprofit boards, anyone who is managing, let's say, our typical bank or law office or CPA office that wants its employees to become involved on boards, would get a good idea of what the expectations are when they would read something like this. So the audience is actually very broad.
I think that this book would be helpful to the small arts organization as well as the mid-sized social service organization or a very large institution such as a hospital or college board. The key is not that you read it from cover to cover, but if every board had one in their possession, this month somebody could read a chapter and say, this is how I think it applies to us. And you just do a round robin through the board so everybody gets a feel for it, but not everybody reads every piece because not every article relates to every organization.
And you don't need to read it cover to cover because there is not a surprise ending.
No.
It is very interesting stuff. And Frank Martinelli, Pat Wyszbinski, and Terry Temkin, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you.
Terry Temkin is editor of the book, part of the In the Trenches series called You and Your Nonprofit Board. It includes chapters by Frank Martinelli, president of the Center for Public Skills Training in Milwaukee, and Pat Wyszbinski, president of Management Cornerstones in Milwaukee. They'll all be part of a book launch tomorrow afternoon at Redline, Milwaukee. There is a link to more from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Another break now, and when we return, auto contributor Mark Savage takes on the idea of gizmo overload on your dashboard. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Do you remember those things? They were made out of paper and they rested on your lap when you drove through an unfamiliar place and then you tried to fold them up in just the right way when you were done. Paper roadmaps have often been left behind by their high-tech cousin, the GPS unit. Of course, the add-on GPS has been supplanted in many cases by a built-in GPS in newer cars to go along with backup cameras, integrated MP3 players, and many more options. You might, in fact, call it gizmo overload. And it's on the minds of our automotive contributor Mark Savage and Lake Effect's Dan Harmon. Savage says he thinks GPS is like a lot of electronics in cars these days. It can be useful, but...
I guess my concern is that because more and more people are getting GPS all the time, and I guess I think it's kind of funny because I think most people I know maybe take one trip a year to go someplace beyond maybe Chicago. And so how much do you really need it? So you're spending still roughly $800 to $900 probably to have a GPS system as part of a package in your car, but you have to have a screen to see the GPS system, and now your radio runs through that screen, and now everything's touchscreen. And frequently, the touchscreens don't work real well in cars, at least in my experience. And so I guess you're adding the cost of that feature. Now, you can dim them, and a lot of times there's a ways to control the different lighting levels and so forth. So like say, maybe it's not quite as distracting at night. The only way I found to shut them off is to usually flip it onto the radio away from the GPS system when you have multiple choices. Then you got the radio light glaring at you, but usually not quite as bad as the GPS screen. But I guess a lot of it to me comes down to in our cars these days is how lazy are we? How lazy do we want to be? Not that it's bad to have a GPS system. I think every rental car should have one. But you can buy a pretty nice Garmin and other brands for maybe $200 and take it with you when you need it. And otherwise, it's not there to bug you. It's not in your way. And I just think it's another layer of complexity, something that can go wrong and that has added cost to a car that not everyone needs. A lot of these are luxury items, but as we've experienced over time, I mean, in the 50s and 60s, power windows were a luxury item only on Cadillacs and Lincolns and things like that. And now everybody's got them. I even question how hard it is to roll up and down a window, but even so, you know, over time, some of these things do work their ways into cars and become a standard item. But it does add cost because you're adding new features and features that weren't there 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago.
The thing that really bugs me about GPS systems is not their usefulness, because they are very useful and they're becoming more and more accurate. It's that if you want other features, for example, as some car makes, if you want to get an upgraded sound system when you get the car new, you have to get GPS. You have to get that screen. You can't just get a stereo. So it's always connected to something else, and then the costs start snowballing.
Well, correct. And that's it, is that the car makers have for years now taken the same approach as, I guess, McDonald's and others, that they're supersizing you. And so you want a package, and I think most of us in our climate, we're happy to have heated seats in a car. But many times heated seats comes with three or four other features and now cost $1,200. And all I wanted was the heated seats. And I think it's kind of funny because in our world of customization and everything can be made a certain, you know, way, cars in some ways have become less customizable, if that's a word, I guess.
Sure, it is now.
Because everything's coming to me in a package.
Are any of these items – I mean, you know, GPS certainly is useful and – are there items that you think are just silly that people are getting? I mean, push-button start. I mean, why is that a cost-saving, energy-saving, as opposed to just turning the key and sticking it in?
Yeah, I don't understand that particularly. My guess is that it's probably safer, that it's harder for a thief to figure out how to do an electronic start because you have to have this fob in your pocket sending a signal. But then again, maybe not. And to me, the fact that most of these fobs are now, you know, the size of five silver dollars packed in your pocket or something as far as the weight goes, and are like the size of a small, you know, or a moderate-sized lighter used to be. So now you've got this big, heavy thing in your pocket. You have to keep it there all the time. When you get in the car, it's in your pocket. It's an extra weight. And what's hard about sticking a key in a car and turning it into ignition? I don't see the difficulty there. Again, it's adding costs. And over time, like I say, these things keep adding up. One of these things that I think is not necessarily silly but frequently doesn't work right is a tire pressure monitor. And I know we may differ on this, but you know, you turn on your car frequently, it will light up. Oh, you know, your left front tire is, you know, two pounds lower, and you got to go through six screens to figure out exactly what it is, which tire, and how low it is. Then you get out and you put your tire gauge on it, which remind the listeners, a tire gauge costs about $1 to $2 to go out and check these things. And it's, you know, exactly right, or maybe it's a pound low. And you think, well, is it a pound low? Is it hot today, or is it cold today, or whatever? Frequently, they don't work right. Frequently, you're going in and having them replaced. I've had friends that tell me, oh, yeah, it's only $350 to have my tire monitor replaced. Okay, well, before that, you just checked your tires with your little gauge that cost $2, and you didn't have to worry about what your tire monitor said. Now, this is not to say that if you're a person who's not observant of your car, that maybe that tire pressure monitor is good, because at least if it lights up every other day and tells you a tire is low, maybe you're going to go check your tires every day. I'm guessing most of the time people just say, eh, they look okay to me, and they move on.
I think another feature that has – at first we may have thought it was silly or just maybe useful, but it would never catch on. I think it's either the backup camera or – even just the backup beeps, I'm not sure, the kind of the backup warning system.
Right. I think the backup camera is one of the best things that has come out. The backup camera and the blind spot warning both make sense to me, because these are safety devices. You're backing out of the driveway. Is there something behind you? If you have kids, they might have left a toy and you didn't see it when you got in the car. You know, there could be a kid on a toy behind you riding a big wheel or something like that behind you. Backing out of parking lots, it's even helpful there. You can look a little bit to the side, but now that you get your tail out a little bit, sometimes you can see whether there's a car coming. I love those kind of things. They're useful. They do add cost. And right now, most of the time, those are options. And you can decide, gee, do I want that? I'm going to pay the extra $1,200 or $1,500 or whatever for that. And do I feel like I'm going to need that? Sure. Then, okay, you've got that choice. There are some crazy things. I don't like the beeps because they're annoying. And they beep usually within like 5 feet of something. So you're pulling into a parking spot in a parking lot, and it starts beeping the second you start pulling into the thing. It's actually a distraction, because the closer you get to something, the more it's beeping. And you think, well, I know I'm getting close to that big light post in front of me. I can see it out the front of my windshield. So I think I know when I'm going to – I should know where my car is and not be bumping into things.
Although I will add that the backup cameras, you will need that screen that contains the GPS.
Correct. But then again, most of us have that now, whether we want it or not, because our radio has that. So it is a catch-22 in some regards. But again, I guess what I like the most is that you have the choice and don't add the cost. So many of the cars – I saw in the paper the other day that the average cost of a sale price of a car or vehicle this last month was $31,600-some dollars. My guess is that most of us would like to pay 20, maybe 25, and even then we're probably stretching it. So if that's the case, I don't need all those things in my car, and I'd like to have the choice of buying a car with less items. And yes, there are some low-priced cars out there, but more and more they have some of these items on them that I'm suspecting that now instead of that car being $15,000 that was a low-cost car, it's now $17,000 or $18,000. So it's price creep caused by all the add-ons that you don't necessarily have to drive a car effectively. And one of my other pet peeves is rain-sensing wipers. And you're thinking, I think I know when it's raining and I can turn on my own wipers. It's not hard. You reach, you pull a knob, you turn a knob. It really doesn't take much effort.
Well, okay. So now I just have to ask you, can you buy a car now that does not have power windows or a car that does not have power brakes? Can you get a powerless car, if you will?
I'm sure you
manual transmission.
I'm sure you can't get all of those. You might get one of those on something, and probably not the brakes. I did have a Ram pickup truck that was a very basic model about a year ago, and it had crank-up windows, and Ironically, I had to drive to Chicago and had to go through toll booths. And you thought, oh, man, now I got crank windows. But it wasn't that hard. But still, it was a surprise because I haven't had a car, I bet, in at least 2 or 3 years prior to that that had anything but power windows. It's there may be one or two out there that still offer it, especially a real low-cost entry-level car. But most everything has the power windows and power brakes. And a lot of them have the electric power steering and everything else now too. So, and just my one other bugaboo is the crazy information systems and not to single out one particularly bad one, but there is one particularly bad one, which is the iDrive system that's been in the BMWs for years. And they have made some improvements to it, so I'll give them some credit for realizing it wasn't working perfectly. But it's basically a big knob on your center console between your seats that serves as a mouse, so you can go through about anywhere from 10 to 1,000 layers of computer functions on your car, and turning on extra features like how long before your lights go out when you turn off the car, the steering power, is it going to be a comfort level or is it going to be a sport level, 60 different radio channels and whether it's satellite or FM and AM and so forth. So you have a lot of things to do. And it's really it would be great if you had a navigator with you at all times and could play with that constantly and look for the things you want. But as you and I discussed beforehand, most of us, I think, especially with radios, probably have maybe 5 stations that we listen to most of the time. And you're going to have those programmed in. And you can still do that in some of these cars, although some it's difficult to even find the stations and program them. I had one that took me, even looking at the manual, about 3 days to figure out how to find an AM or an FM channel. I was whatever it was on when I got the car. You could find the channels on that, but you couldn't switch to the other band for, it wasn't intuitive, we'll put it that way. I realize, too, with all cars, and I'm test driving them usually for a week, but most cars, within a week or two, you'll probably have things programmed the way you want. But I really don't feel I should have a mechanical or electrical engineering degree just to find all the functions on my car.
And you don't remember it when you have to do it again.
Correct. It's like programming your VCR or whatever you want to say out there is if you don't do it every day or two, you're probably not going to remember it.
Do you think any automakers are catching on or are hearing that some customers want to get back to simplicity?
Well, I guess I've seen a number of cars that I've had lately, and I would say mostly the American cars, that have had a simpler dash and gone back to like 6 radio buttons. And yes, you can, many times put 2 or 3 channels on a button on different layers. And that's not hard. So, I guess I feel like that's responding to it to a certain degree. And I know some auto columnists are now counting all the buttons on their dashes and putting that in. I did that years ago, and I think I topped out at like 74, 70 or something like that with an Alpha, which, of course, we haven't had to worry about for a number of years. Maybe we will in our near future. Mm-hmm. But, I think there is some idea from the automakers that maybe it's become too complex now, and they're going to dial it back some.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mark. I'll talk to you next month.
All right. Great. Thanks.
Mark Savage writes about cars for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he is our regular automotive contributor. He talked with Dan Harmon about the notion of gizmo overload in cars. Savage is also editor of American Snowmobiler magazine and proprietor of a website and a Facebook page. You will find links from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then 2 lifelong Boston Red Sox fans will try not to be overly self-indulgent on the radio. Bet you can't wait. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The saying goes, at least in the movie A League of Their Own, that there's no crying in baseball. But anyone who has been a lifelong Boston Red Sox fan, and yes, that group includes yours truly, will tell you there is a lot of crying in baseball. Crying at misfortune, a certain error by first baseman Bill Buckner in the 86 World Series, and a home run by Aaron Boone in the 2003 American League Championship Series. And crying at good fortune, the Sox comeback from 3 games down to the Yankees in the 2004 ALCS and their first World Series win in 86 years about a week later. They're almost universal experiences for the members of Red Sox Nation. But why people would choose to root for this star-crossed ball club is another story, and it's chronicled by Milwaukee writer Greg Pearson, whose new book is called Fenway Fanatics. Pearson joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So this is the question that I suspect a lot of people who have grown up in this part of the world have. What is the difference, if there is any, between being a lifelong Red Sox fan and a lifelong fan of practically any other team, like say, the Brewers?
Well, I think one thing with the Red Sox is they go back 110 years. And so you get generation after generation that's rooted for this team through good and bad. There was a lot of bad there from 1920 to 1970 or so. But the fans will pass this on from generation to generation. One thing in my book that came up time and again were people getting talked to by their grandfather or their father or their mother saying, you know, root for this team, but don't have too many high expectations. You know, we don't know what will happen, but it probably won't be good. But I think, you know, there was understanding if children are rooting for other teams. You know, one dad talked about how his son started rooting for the Toronto Blue Jays because he liked the logo. You know? And when it went on for a couple of years, the dad started to get a little nervous. But eventually the son came around to the dad's way of thinking on what team he was rooting for. I think this book could be written about any team, you know, but I do think the Red Sox have that special connection with generations, you know, six-state region that pretty much roots just for this one team. Obviously, there are exceptions as you get closer to the New York border and into upstate New England. There used to be folks that actually rooted for Montreal when they had a team, and Toronto has some fans up that way as well. But the whole region seems to pull for the Red Sox, and it really makes it kind of one big community when it comes to the baseball season, which I think is a little unusual. You know, obviously the New England states are a little small, which adds to that effect.
There also seems to be something distinct about the attitude of Red Sox fans towards their team. I remember there was a Dave Barry book. It was like his guide to the 50 states. He describes people from Massachusetts, and he says the two distinctions of Massachusetts people are having funny accents and expecting the Red Sox to screw up. there is a sense of foreboding when you are a Red Sox fan that does not necessarily exist when you're a Brewers fan.
I think some of that is true. The Red Sox certainly had many prime examples of kind of blowing it in the clutch, you know, some terrible losses, some just heartbreaking, excruciating losses. And Red Sox fans can be pretty self-involved that way too. I think we like to talk about all our past failings. And you know, when they won it all in 2004 and again in 2007, some of that faded. Some fans will still talk in those old-fashioned ways of, you know, oh, we're going to blow it, we're going to lose it. And but I think it's toned down a bit, and but certainly there were some reasons to feel that way along the way. And one of the dads I talked to in the book talked about watching the 2007 World Series with his son, and their views of it were just the opposite. You know, the son said, "Oh, we're going to win. You know, we just won 3 years ago," and the dad was like, "No, we're going to blow it. We're going to blow it."
It so, does not work this way.
Right.
Well, why did you want to write this book? You are a Red Sox fan, and you include some of your own memories in this book, but mostly you are capturing other people's memories. Why was this the story you wanted to tell?
I just, as a kid growing up, I always was struck by how many folks in New England cared about this team. And I knew these stories were out there, and I just thought it would be fun to pull them all together. And it, one thing I tried to do is not make it too much of fans talking about, woe is me, you know, the Red Sox are going to blow it, because I think that gets a little tired for everybody to hear. But I just think some of these family stories are really touching and wonderful, funny, sad. One of my favorite chapters in the book is a woman named Jean DeRoche, who is from the Boston area, and she actually died 3 years ago. But I found out about her just – I was on the internet one day doing some research for the book, and I stumbled across her obit. And her obit starts out, wicked big Red Sox fan, attended 56 consecutive opening days. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good lead. And I read through this, and throughout her obit it referenced the Red Sox and other Boston teams as well. And at the very end, she talked about how for her wake, she wanted people to come dressed in Red Sox apparel. And people did. And I just thought that was so wonderful. I looked at the survivors listed in her obit, found her daughter, found the name, called her right away. She was out walking her dog, and she was just thrilled to talk about her mom. And, you know, her mom was one of these fans that just never gave up. never lost hope, didn't ever flinch on this team at all. And I thought for someone who, you know, followed this team for 65, 70 years before she died in her mid-80s, I think that was remarkable. And she was a wonderful story and one of those people I wish I could have known in life.
Well, and I would imagine as you reached out to the 50 fans that you profile in this book, did you have any trouble getting any of them to talk about their love for the Red Sox?
No, not at all. It's, you know, I've worked in newspapers my whole career, and when you do interviews, right away you start thinking, is this going to work? Is there a lead here? Is there a good story here? And a couple of the interviews, you know, were a little sluggish at first, and then all of a sudden you'd hit a story and that person would go off and they'd have this great tale about going to a game with their grandparents or, you know, talking to their son about the Red Sox or who knows what. And it just came out. There were very few people I interviewed that didn't end up in the book because everybody had at least a few good stories. And the chapters I wrote on each person are pretty short. You know, some of those people, it only includes one or two anecdotes, but I think that's all you need to have them tell about their love of the Red Sox. And I obviously didn't want the book to be too repetitive with people telling the same kind of stories because there were some similar themes.
Well, let's talk about your own experiences for just a few moments. What were the formative moments that cemented you as a Red Sox fan?
Well, I'm 58, pushing 59, and so I've been doing this for a long time with this team. And I think really anybody my age, they're going to start talking, first of all, about 1967, you know, which was the season where when I first started rooting for the Red Sox, they were terrible. And as I said in the book, I'm really not sure what attracted me. What was the reason I started rooting for these losers? But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they just got good. I mean, nobody expected it. There were no real major changes in the team. It was just they had a new manager. A couple of young players came in and really played well. A couple of older players that they'd had for a while suddenly found it. And then Karl Yastrzemski was always a good player with the team, but he was spectacular in 67. And they just had this crazy season where they won games they had no business winning, and it was a five-team race throughout most of the summer.
One of the things that really strikes me in this collection of remembrances, really, of Red Sox of the past and you know, these profiles of fans is how many of the Red Sox fans you found had no natural connection to New England or the Red Sox, but somehow got themselves swept up in Red Sox Nation, if you will. There's a guy from Ukraine.
Correct.
who more or less arbitrarily took on the Red Sox?
Well, he got hooked on the Red Sox through video games and Stephen King novels. So it's a different kind of combination to get there. But he knew of King's writing, and through that he found out about King's love for the Red Sox. King wrote a book called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
Who was a Red Sox relief pitcher.
Correct. And there were many references in that book to the Red Sox and Tom Gordon's role in the whole bit. The girl, I think, was from Maine in the book and got lost in the woods, and she used Gordon as kind of her goal to get out of the woods. You know, he was the guy that was protecting her and saving her through the night when she was out there by herself. So it's a wonderful story. But he read that, and that just got him even more into this whole Red Sox thing. And he started getting videos and, you know, got some kind of cable TV package that you can get in Ukraine to watch Red Sox baseball. And he's a diehard fan. He has a blog he does in Russian about baseball. And there's another family from Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska, Bill and John Opinski, who I interviewed both of them. Their dad had moved from Scranton, Pennsylvania as a teen, you know, right out of high school. He decided to go to Alaska and find his way there.
And at the time there had been a Red Sox farm team in Scranton.
Right. And that was the dad's attraction to the Red Sox. You know, he was seeing former or future Red Sox players play in Scranton, and once they made the big leagues, he was, you know, as many of us do when we go to minor league games, thinking, "Oh yeah, that guy, I remember seeing him 5 years ago in, you know, Scranton."
Not that this wouldn't necessarily be the case for Miller Park or for, I don't know, Kauffman Stadium or the ballpark at Arlington. But, you know, you have people – there's a guy that you profile in northern Vermont who has built a Fenway Park wiffle ball stadium in his yard.
Correct. It's a one-quarter scale of Fenway Park, and it's got the left field wall, and it's got the foul poles and the – retired Red Sox numbers hanging in right field. It really looks very authentic. There are a couple of pictures of it in the book. And one thing I did find many times over were that people, as much as they loved the team, it was the ballpark that first got them hooked. You know, they came to the park and just thought, this is a special kind of place. And, you know, Miller Park is a great place to see a game. You know, there's no doubt about it. You go in there, you can see wonderful sight lines, and it's a terrific place to see a game. And there are some things with Fenway that are not as attractive. You know, the seats are not always very comfortable, and you can be sitting out in right field facing the right fielder. So you have to turn your neck far to the left to watch the action at home plate. But there's that charm of something that's been there for 101 years now, you know, and you sit there and you think, you know, geez, Babe Ruth played here. That doesn't happen at many parks anymore these days. Wrigley and Fenway are the only two that go back that far now.
You know, this is a question that I think only a Red Sox fan could ask another Red Sox fan without seeming annoying. Was it hard for you to reconcile in your mind when the Red Sox won two World Series, the Red Sox that were now part of baseball culture with everything you had experienced up until that point?
You know, I really didn't have a problem with that at all. I was okay. But I know some people raise that thought of, you know, if the Red Sox ever win, we're going to lose our identity. And I think it's a good identity to lose. One of my good friends in high school who I mentioned in the book was a guy named Don Ackerman, who still lives in the Boston area. And his dad was a diehard Red Sox fan too. And Don was watching the 86 World Series with his dad. And he remembers feeling like, you know, he was on the verge of tears. And then he looked at his dad, his dad was like one of the rocks of our little town in Connecticut. You know, he owned the general store. He'd been a star athlete in high school at the local high school. And he said he saw his dad on the verge of tears. And it said that really got to him, you know, because his dad was one of those guys that just never cried. And sadly, his dad died a few years before the Red Sox did win it all.
And if we worried that the Red Sox had and Red Sox Nation had lost its identity, we always had 2011 to look at.
Right. And you think about, there's so many teams that go through tough, tough losses. I mean, the Red Sox built a cottage industry on talking about their bad losses. But you look at what the Texas Rangers went through over the last few years. You know, they lost a World Series they should have won. They lost another World Series. They lost a playoff game the first time they had a one-game playoff. They were the team that lost it, you know.
And we don't ever hear about that being part of the Rangers' identity,
right,
exactly.
Right, and, you know, Brewer fans, I'm sure, can point to moments, too, in their history. You know, certainly the 82 World Series was a tough one to lose. They had a 3-2 lead in the series and ended up losing the last two games. And every fan of every team goes through this. You know, the Red Sox maybe took it to an extreme sometimes with some of their incredible ways of losing. But fans, that's part of being a fan. You know, you've got to take the good with the bad. And I think one thing in doing this book is I think it's made me a better fan.
Well, Greg Pearson, thanks so much, and keep the faith.
You too, Mitch. Thank you.
Milwaukee writer Greg Pearson's new book is called Fenway Fanatics, 50 Boston Red Sox Fans Tell Their Stories. He'll talk about all things Red Sox at an all-star break night this evening at Boswell Book Company, along with fellow baseball writers Dave Heller and Tom Haudricourt, who will talk about his book aimed more at Brewers fans. There is a link to more information from WUWM.com. I'm Mitch Teich, signing off from Red Sox Nation. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock. Oh, send us some light.